believe they can. Now, in part, we're going to be dealing with the checks and balances of the structure. If that evangelist is teaching something that's wrong, or if he is demonstrating an attitude that is not as it should be, if his behavior or his teaching are wrong, then the recourse is that that evangelist is under elders, and all complaints about evangelists go back to their elders. That would be the way to begin to deal with that process. Other questions or thoughts? Tom? Oh, sure. Yeah, I assume that that conversation already take place, but I shouldn't assume that. Thank you. Sure. What we can deal with on an informal, amicable level, we should. But if it comes to it, all complaints, if they want to register a formal complaint against that evangelist, they do it by going to his elders. All right. Tim, was that enough about the selection? Yeah, that's not good. The Lord's plan is so simple, people can hardly leave it alone. And yet it's so beautiful. We're not going to improve on it. David. Okay. All right. The apostles were the first elders. Exactly. And since you've brought that up, I just want to make one point about it, that particular word, diakoneo, which is a word that can be used either officially or unofficially. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three, the same expression is made there, that when Jesus healed Peter's wife's mother, she arose and ministered unto them. This is the word that's used there. It's also the same word that's used in that same passage we were just looking at in Acts 6 and 2. And there in the King James Bible, it's translated as the word serve. It is not reason that we should leave the Word of God and serve tables. And the same word, again, is also used in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 10. This time translated by six English words in the King James Bible, use the office of a deacon. So it has an official and an unofficial application. But I think this helps us to know who was being appointed in the sixth chapter of Acts, because this word is actually used, and over here it's the same word translated, use the office of a deacon. Even though we don't have the English word deacon in most translations of it, the sixth chapter of Acts. Appreciate it, David. Thank you. Was there another? Dean. Good question. Yes, the example that we have, the apostles made the first appointment there in Acts 6. We have an example of an apostle and an evangelist doing appointing of elders in Acts 14. Later on, the apostle Paul gave to evangelists, not to churches, but to evangelists, to Timothy and to Titus, lists of qualifications. That's the only example we have. It maintains the checks and balances. And I'll tell you, it is amazing in a lot of congregations the recommendations you get as to who to appoint as an elder or a deacon. You wouldn't think, maybe, I wouldn't think that it would be that way. But you get the recommendations of people who are not even married, who don't have children. I don't understand it, but I know it's true. If you have an evangelist that some congregation somewhere has has deemed with its eldership to send out, then hopefully he's going to have enough grasp of the qualifications to not let that type of thing slip through to fruition. I think we definitely still need both of those grids, and sometimes even then we set the standards a little low, I think. I knew there were hands. I'm not sure who was next. Tom, I think you were, though. Was able to leave town. Yeah, you betcha. Shell down the corn, that's what it is. Exactly right. Seldom do you go through this process without some feathers being ruffled somewhere along the line. It's an unfortunate thing. I know there was, oh, it's Marvin, I'm sorry. I thought you weren't going to comment in this fact. I gave away your promise, I'm sorry too. You just take all the time you want. Yes. Yes, I do. But I don't think we take it as every member having an equal voice. If somebody walks in off the street right now and they're baptized into Christ and they become a member of this congregation, they, in my way of thinking, would not have a voice that should be equal to the elders of this congregation who have been with it from the beginning and know the ins and outs. If we happen to be in the process of looking for candidates for offices, I would take some people's voice as having more weight than others. I think that's only realistic. Did you have a thought?
Well, I was thinking that sometimes we get the idea that the elders that are already in position have the major voice in choosing the elder that will be appointed.
Okay. They do have a weighty voice, because these are people that they're going to have to work with. If we're going to appoint another elder, I think they have a weightier voice than some people might, but the rest of the congregation definitely has a voice as well. Definitely. All right, Fonda. Okay. All right. About resignation. I believe that it should not be done, and no, we don't have examples of it per se. However, we can only think that it must have happened in the case of Philip, for instance. He was at the church at Jerusalem, and he was ordained as a deacon. And then later on, we find him living up at Caesarea, and he's an evangelist. Now, he's not going to be a deacon and evangelist at the same time in two different cities that far apart with travel as it was in that day. So if somebody moves away, it would seem to me that it would be necessary for them to resign from that office, even though we don't have examples of it. You can't serve the elders which are among you. If he's no longer going to be among you, he's going to have to resign. But I do not believe that resignation should be done for light or transient causes, but also recognizing that God does not expect us to do things that we can't do. If a man is no longer able to function in that, then I think he would have the option to resign. I don't believe he would have to, but I think he would have the option to. Now, there are some people who don't believe in resigning, and if he didn't believe in resign, I would not try to get him to resign unless he was a problem in the congregation. Even if he's deaf and his capacities are diminishing, if nothing else, he can serve as a wonderful example as long as he doesn't become a problem. So he can continue until his death in that office, and nobody should say he can resign because he can't hear anymore and he's not on top of it like he used to be. I think there is a place for it. I think sometimes we see it overdone, and the fact that the Bible doesn't talk about it should give us pause there. Once I have this obligation, I better do it, you know, with consistency and for a long time rather than just resign because of some light reason. We have to let people make their own judgments on that, in my opinion. Lynette.
Mm-hmm.
I feel the same way, and the people who take the position that it does seldom would take the same position if his children all died, which would be an equivalent thing if that had to continue as a qualification. My view is that when his wife dies, she's already had her 50 years of effects on him, and he doesn't become a different person. He must be a married man at the time of his appointment, obviously. And I can't say it any better than you did. Steve, I didn't get to you a while ago. Yes. Okay. Yes. Right. She's even on the list, not by name, but deaconess down here. That would be an example. And I wish I'd numbered these questions, but it's 1, 2, 3, 4 down. Are there other positions? That would be an example. The ones we've been talking about, elder, deacon, evangelist, in the church today, these are the apostles and prophets, of course, are still in the church today in a sense. But as far as people living on the earth now, we have these three appointive offices or functions. There are innumerable other possible unofficial positions. If you want to call them positions, and I'm not sure exactly how the word position is meant here, but for instance, over at Murray Road, sometimes you go over there and there's somebody walking around that has a little tag that says, "I am the announcer." Well, that is that a position or isn't it? It's an unofficial function. It's a job that that person's been given for that particular month. And some places have a greeter. Somebody will say, "Well, I'm the greeter this month." They're supposed to stand at the door and greet everybody that comes in so nobody falls through the cracks. So you're going to have parking lot attendants, which we have Sunday, and all kinds of things like that. That secretary is on here. Dolores Van Dusen has done a lot of secretarial work at the congregation that I'm a member of. I don't know if anybody ever called her a secretary, but they certainly could have. It wouldn't have been out of place to call her that. But she's more concerned with getting the work done than with what the title is, and that's good example for all of us. All right, Bill, I think, I'm sorry, I'll try to get back over here in a minute. Okay. Well, I think you could take it either way. The easiest way to take it is just to be talking about the wives of deacons. People have often asked about the wives of elders, but the role of a deacon is a little bit different than that of elder. Not that an elder doesn't need a good wife, because he does. But the role of a deacon is involving other people's money and physical things that other people shouldn't know about. And if he has a wife who is a slanderer or a gossip, it can cause him a special kind of trouble. So that could be one possible reason there. But I think it's also possible to interpret that he's referring back to the other. But I can't prove it, so I don't really stress that. Definitely talking about the deacon's wives, whether it would apply to the others is the way you take it, I think. Go ahead. Okay, I know you do. Go ahead. I understand. And if for some reason that second wife would disqualify him, then he would need to step out. That's true. Appreciate the point. Thank you. Did you want to follow up on that, or just let it stand? Okay. Good point. I appreciate you bringing it to our attention. Now, there was one here, Michael. It doesn't have that phrase with the elders. Well, okay. The elder's qualifications, I think, would indicate the same thing, that he is tested to see if he meets those qualifications. You can't tell if he's apt to teach unless we've tested to see whether he can teach, for instance. You can't tell if he's would be able to stop the mouths of the gainsayers unless you've kind of seen him tested in that role a little bit. So anybody, elder or deacon candidate, needs to be tested, and tested over a period of time to see, so that we have an indication of how he would function. This is one reason why we don't put a new plant, a novice, into the office, because we need to see him over time. He needs the time to grow and get over the possible pride that would come if he was put in when he's new. And we need the time to see him. It's a testing time for all of us. Did you have a thought on that? Okay. Dean, I think you're next. Then Lois. Yes. Not at all. No, if his conscience dictates to him that he must, or if he feels that it's best in that situation, I believe we have to, you know, I like to be able to make some decisions about myself and my life and what I'm doing, and I think we have to let people have that option for themselves too. Very good. Lois. Yes. Okay, thank you. That's where I was trying to get a couple hours ago. Can there be just one elder? Excuse me. All right, I wouldn't appoint just one elder in a congregation that did not have any elders, because it does always speak of a plurality, and that's part of the checks and balances that we read about down here later on. Paul said to the Ephesian elders, take heed to yourselves. And there is a sense in which elders can take heed to each other. And as long as they don't get divided in their eldership, they can help each other a whole lot. So the Bible does always speak of a plurality. A presbytery is a group of elders. I personally believe that if a man is left in office, in the example that Lois has raised, there's two elders, one of them dies. I personally believe that he is left there as a single elder. We've got to remember that the Holy Spirit did make him an overseer, and I don't believe that he needs to resign. Obviously, if his conscience dictates that he must, then he must. But I don't believe there's anything incumbent on him in resigning, because if he does, then you're going to put the congregation back under an evangelistic oversight, which is still a temporary one-man system. And how are you any better off? Either way, you've got one man, and you hope it's as temporary as it can possibly be. That elder, of course, would love to have another qualified elder there. But sometimes it can't be for a while. I respect a man who stays in the office alone and does what he can to fulfill his function there. And I always think of Rebecca on this. I don't know why it's not particularly applicable in any New Testament way, but I always think of what she said about her boys when Jacob was going to be so mad at, or when Esau was going to be so mad at Jacob. She said, why should I be deprived of them both in one day? Meaning that if Esau kills Jacob, then Esau is going to be subject to capital punishment himself for the murder, and they're both going to be gone. Why inflict that secondary punishment on a congregation? It's already lost one of its elders. Why should it lose both of them the same day? Now, I'm aware that some people have definite scruples about this and feel that there should be a plurality, and if one man is left, he should step down. And if that is your conviction, then that's what you must do. Did you have a thought on that, Lois? All right. Dean, I think you were next. That makes sense to me. You sure don't want to attempt to work in a congregation. It's much better, I'll put it that way, much better if you have the backing. Ray, I think you were first.
Well, I think it's better if those that
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or develop two or three more, as many as we can, and then let the congregation select among a number of qualified men, and maybe they'll select them all. Absolutely. This ought to be ongoing. As one of our big problems is, people get to be about 88 years old and then start looking around for where's the leadership of the future coming from. We need to be looking, well, all the time. It's just an ongoing process. Tom, was that your hand?
Yes, if you have a couple of shepherds looking after 20,000 head of sheep up in Wyoming and lightning kills one of them, you don't want the other one to go off and leave the flock.
Thank you very much. Was that you, Mike?
That wasn't what I was
going to say. No, I mean, but it seemed like there were three in a row here, and I'm trying to get them all.
No, actually, you did come
back. Okay. There was a hand here. Tim. Yourselves, uh-huh. I see that in taking heed to yourselves and the flock. He distinguishes themselves from the flock. You elders take heed of yourselves personally and each other as well as the flock. I think primarily it's to each individual taking care of himself, but I also believe that the eldership needs to take care of itself as an eldership. And while we're on this point, I think it's important for elders generally to recognize and respect the fact that they are part of an eldership, and to not act in a unilateral way that is going to compromise the leadership of the eldership as a whole. And sometimes when you're just used to being you, it's hard to get used to the fact that there are other people to consult. It's kind of like getting married or lots of things where we take on an additional responsibility where there's somebody else to talk to first. It's one of the things that new elders in particular need to remember, to talk to the others before we make any hard line decision here. Appreciate it. Marlene. Well, no, I don't recommend one deacon. Sometimes it happens. Yes, I do think under an eldership you could appoint one deacon. But even there, it's better if we have more to help. But you're not going to have a problem with a one-man leadership because the deacon is not the leader in spiritual things. In the sense of having the authority. Mike, I guess you're the only one at the moment.
What about some qualifications that aren't specifically mentioned or listed? For example, it's quite unpopular in our culture, and we seem to have biblical reasons for this also, to not participate in the use of tobacco products. But if a man who's being considered is one who does so,
okay. I think in these kind of topics, generally, you have to consider the mores of the community, of good report of them that are without. In some cases, that would mean something a little different than in other places. I would never appoint a man who smokes to the eldership. That's just me. It's not, the Bible does not explicitly say that. But I would personally, it would be against my conscience to do that. If I knew that he smoked, I would never do that. But it's not, there's all kinds of gradations here. Is chewing is bad? And so you, in every situation, you'd have to put everything into the hopper and make a judgment call. But yes, I think it is possible for a congregation as a whole and an elder also to have things like that are a part of the consideration, though they're not explicitly mentioned in the list of qualifications. If a man seems to be qualified according to the qualifications as you and I look at them, that still does not mean that congregation has to accept him as an elder. They're under no obligation to recommend anybody for an elder if they're not comfortable with the fact that he would be a leader of the congregation. And there may be something that somebody just can't put their finger on. That needs to be talked out. We need to get to the bottom of it and find out what it is. But we don't want to run roughshod over people's intuitions on these types of things, because in many cases they've known them a long time, and maybe there is a rat under the corn crib someplace and nobody's quite ferreted it out yet, but they got a feeling. They need to have shepherds that they can be comfortable in following, if at all possible. Good question. Esther. I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. If he's been divorced and remarried, is he still the husband of one wife? It's possible that if he has been divorced and remarried, that he might still be the husband of one wife. There is a legitimate reason for divorce and remarriage, and there are a few million illegitimate reasons for divorce and remarriage. So that would have to be taken into account. But it's also possible in that kind of a scenario that if he has been divorced and remarried, he can still be the husband of one wife if the circumstances are right, but he might not be blameless. That qualification of blamelessness there covers a large area of ground. And the problem we run into here is if he's been divorced and remarried, there may be a lot of things that people don't know about, and there's some uncertainty there. Not that we want to pry into his business, but we just don't know. And that may be a cloud over him that would follow him throughout. So to me, that is a strike against him, even if it was no fault of his own, because we don't all know that it was no fault of his own. And it puts a great big question mark above him. And everything then has to be taken into consideration from that point. Milford, I guess you were next. Is that a... Right. Yes, it does. Certainly does. Thank you. Tom. Right. But that is a specific glean from a generality. And I think that's what Mike was talking about, just how far do you go with that. It can be a judgment call. Sometimes, not specifically about tobacco, I'm not talking. To me, that's fairly clear cut. But that's to me. And in other centuries, in other places, before we knew what we knew, what we know now about tobacco, it might have been different. Is that a follow-up? Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Yes. Yes, he will. Right. Very good point. Absolutely. I keep that. Okay, Winford. Talk to you. We need to do the best we can, and if you have the option, it might be better to have somebody with a few miles on him have some experience. That's true. Very good. I appreciate it. There was another one. Well, I keep getting people that have already talked, which is great, but if there's somebody who hasn't, I don't want to overlook you. Tim, go ahead. Oh, I can. Well, I think both of those factors may have been there. But when the Holy Spirit says a one-woman man, and that's the literal expression here, a one-woman man, he's talking about somebody who is abiding by God's plan from the very beginning, this singularity. There's more difference between one and two than there is between two and a million. And thou shalt have no other gods before me. That singleness of purpose in service to God. Jesus said, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me. And I think that went a long way toward what we were discussing in the last hour, as was pointed out, as to why he did not sin, because his very sustenance was to do the will of his Father. And if we kept that before our eyes the way he did, we wouldn't have near the sin problem that we do. Just as we have that singular focus on the one God, there's that singular focus on the one wife. I think that's why it's included. He needs to be a man who's familiar with family living, because so much of the work of an elder is very much the same as that. This is, I believe, why he has to have children. I'm speculating as to why, because the Lord didn't say for sure, except he said, if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? So much of what an elder deals with is like dealing with squabbling children, and he needs to already have demonstrated that he's capable of doing that. Steve. Yes. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, but it would rule out polygamy.
It would.
Right. Okay. Dean. Titus 1:5 is the one I was using. I did not personally use the word evangelistic oversight, by the way. But I do believe that there is such a thing as a temporary evangelistic authority in a congregation without elders. He has the same basic authority that the elders will later on have. Think about it, and if you want to follow up later, that's fine. Anybody else? Okay. Well, that's unusual. Okay, Lee, go ahead.
There's nothing on here about an elder who has gone away with it.
Okay. Let's look at the checks and balances and see if that answers where you're going. If it doesn't, we'll... Well, we can. Yeah, that's the next question, so let's cover it under that topic. Checks and balances of the structure. I think that's probably part of what was intended here. These questions I just wrote down off of the list that was given to me. But I think that's surely what's meant here. And we do have checks and balances in the church as God structured it. Elders appoint evangelists. 1 Timothy 4:14. Neglect not the gift that is in thee that was given thee by prophecy together with the laying on of the hands of the presbytery. Timothy was appointed by his elders, and then elders appoint evangelists. For this cause left I thee in Crete, Titus 1:5, that thou mightest set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city. Paul and Barnabas ordained elders in the churches where they were in the 14th chapter of Acts. So we pretty solidly can nail those points down. There are other passages to consider too, but I don't think we have much need to do more on that scripturally at this moment. All right, then what if somebody goes wayward? Obviously, if one of us who is a member who does not hold an office goes wayward, then it's up to the evangelist in charge or the elders, if you have elders, to take the lead in helping the congregation deal with that situation. If you have an evangelist who goes wayward, then as we already said, charges against evangelists come back to their elders. But if you have an elder that goes wayward, what do you do? You're the congregation. The elder has authority over you, but he's either teaching things which he should not, or he's living in such a way that he should not, or demonstrating an attitude that is not good. Then what do you do? Well, the Bible does allow for this, as you well know, in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and about the 19th verse there. Against an elder, receive not an accusation, except in the mouth of two or three witnesses. In other words, it's not just one person who is quibbling about the way an elder is behaving. It has to be, the Old Testament principle too was, in the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. So it takes at least two or three, and preferably, if the elder is that far wrong, there are going to be even more than that who would bring these charges. And in that case, you would bring in an evangelist, or I think probably preferably there a group of evangelists, although one evangelist could do it, in order to hear the charges and make a determination. But they must understand that they are only called into that situation to deal with that specific thing, assuming there are other elders in the congregation as well. That congregation is still under its eldership, and those evangelists must not overstep and take over the functioning place of that eldership. But if one elder needs to be dealt with, then they're there specifically to hear the charges against him and to deal with the ramifications of that. If there's somebody else in the congregation that's causing a problem, they can make recommendations about that. But they have to be sure they don't overstep their authority if there is still an eldership in place there. Okay? That was your after? Jay. Well, it depends on how severe the problem is. They probably have already tried to handle it, or they wouldn't be calling the evangelist in.
So then you have to have an evangelist though for him to step down?
Oh, no, he can step down whenever he decides to. You would have to have an evangelist there to put him out.
Against his will.
Yes. Right. No, he probably won't. He'll probably have to be put out if the charges are accurate. Oh, sure. Definitely the congregation is involved. But the same authority that put him into the office takes him out. John. Yes, them that sin rebuke before all, that others may learn. Now these circumstances, of course, once again, we have an infinite gradation of possible exacerbations in these situations, right? So the rebuke, there are a number of forms that rebuke can take. You try to be as gentle as you can, yet as firm as you have to be, if you don't mind my stealing a phrase, Thomas Lee. All right, the question is, can one member rebuke another member? And we were talking about people that do not hold an office. Is it possible scripturally to rebuke, for one member to rebuke another member in the New Testament sense with all the implications of what that word means? What do you think about that? What did you have in mind there, Lee, with the a special meaning? Okay. Well, I'm sorry. Okay, Tom, go ahead.
17:3.
Read it.
Take heed to yourselves, if thy brother trespass against thee, rebuke him, and if you repent, forgive him.
Okay. Luke 17:3. If thy brother trespass against thee, rebuke him. Apparently so, yes. Okay. But I agree with what may have been a part of your point there. The rebuke of a member who is not holding an office would not necessarily carry the same weight as a rebuke from somebody who does. We all ought to help each other, and if rebuking is a part of that process, then so be it. But if your elders rebuke you, I would think that would have a special weight because of who these people are and what their authority is. Marvin?
Are they not rebuking on behalf of the congregation, not just on their?
Well, it would depend on what it is. I was thinking of just, they see something in your life and they come to you privately and make it, maybe it's something that nobody even knows about, but they come to you privately and rebuke you about that. And they, maybe they wouldn't even actually rebuke you the first time. Maybe they'd just warn you. And then next it would be a rebuke. And then there is that statement that says rebuke them sharply. So there's all different levels here too. John, I think you're next.
In 1 Timothy 5:20, we talk about the evangelist rebuking elders who are saved.
No, it would not necessarily indicate that. There's a possibility that you could rebuke and a man might repent and be retained in the office. But you're right. Usually when it comes to that point, he is removed from the office, which it itself is a form of rebuke. Now, I'm not sure who was first, but I saw Dean first, so. There needs to be a communication, verbal or otherwise, that this has been dealt with. If there was a problem, it's been dealt with. I think Tim was next. Okay, yeah. The first thing we should do if an elder is wayward is just go and talk with him about it personally, if at all possible. I mean, if he will hear you. I mean, if he will listen to the words that you're saying. We try, we go up through the steps, and the first ones are very informal, just conversational. It's only when we've already gotten past that we get into the polarization, and usually by the time an evangelist would get there would be a severe polarization, ordinarily. So it's caused by us not living according to the tenets of the New Testament. In answer to your question, that's what causes it. Too much pride, etc. You may have been hitting at something else. Feel free to come back pretty soon. Bill. Okay.
And the effect of a band overall relates to the second chapter between Paul and Peter. Peter separates himself from the Gentiles and Jews and anyone.
Right.
And Paul's experience of faith.
Right.
They were both on the same level.
Right. Very good.
So the spirit is a real blessing to someone.
It is. It is. We all, when someone does come to us and point out a problem in our life, we need to recognize that it probably would have been easier for them to just ignore it and bury their head in the sand and just pretend. So at least we need to assume, if we possibly can, that it's a spirit of love that prompts this and receive it in that manner. Even if they're not real good at the way they come across, we need to take the truth of what they're saying and try to apply it. I think it was Abraham Lincoln who said he learned a lot more that he needed to know from his enemies than he did from his friends. Your friends may be afraid to tell you what you really need to hear. It's a nice thing about being married, isn't it? She's not only your best critic, she's also your worst one, and the average one of us needs a good and bad critic. Jay?
I think it's interesting to note that while we recognize an inspired authority in this, there still are some here that sometimes
Very true, and I appreciate that. Thank you. But I'm sorry that we've come to the end of our time. I can hardly believe we're at the end of our week, and we had a couple of days' worth of stuff that we did not cover. And I apologize for that. I could have rammed it through, but I just made a judgment not to. I did to some extent still, but I hope that the people who assigned me to teach on these things will feel that I did my assignment. Maybe they won't, but I'd like to see them cover instrumental music and the Lord's Supper in one day. It would be possible to talk about them. My problem is that if we're going to broach the subject at all, I don't want to bring up instrumental music and then shoot a few BBs at it. I feel like we need to give it both barrels or we can leave a wrong impression. We didn't even give it both barrels. We still didn't deal with the harps in heaven, but we're never going to get to that now. But at least we gave it a barrel and a half, maybe. And the same thing on these other things. If I feel like I've been hurrying all my life, and when I feel hurried, I feel harried, and I start talking faster and saying things that I don't mean or that can be easily misunderstood. So I hope it was understandable. But I'd rather deal with some subjects and give them some coverage and let the other go. I think one thing we can do, that you have a page on institutions, but I was asked next week to talk about the restoration movement. When we get to the opening of Bethany College in 1841 and the beginning of the American Christian Missionary Society in 1849 with Alexander Campbell elected as the first president in absentia, then that would be a natural place to at least say a few words about the institutions and fellowship and membership. I don't know what we're going to do. Talk to your kids. We talked about it downstairs. Thank you. Well, I guess you want to make some announcements? If there are no announcements, does anybody have an Dean? The Lord made the statement that upon this rock I will build my church in Matthew 16:18. In other words, when he said that I will build my church, he meant that it was his church. He built it exactly the way that he wanted it, and he said the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it, that is, against the establishment of the church. He built it the way he wanted it in every way. We have to believe, if we believe in the omniscience of God and the foreknowledge of God, that he knew what he wanted and was capable of making the church that way, with regard to every aspect, its creed, its rule of faith, its worship, its organization, its names, its mission, and on. Everything about it in the simple beauty that God wanted. There is no man on the earth who has the right to change the pattern of the church as God has given it to us. And when people do that, they are merely producing something else other than the church which the Lord gave us. And that's why we have the mess that we have in the so-called denominational world. We have to recall that people often depart from the way that the Lord has given us in his plan. They do this for a number of different motivations. Many times people sincerely feel that they can make an improvement upon what God has given us in the Bible. But when they feel that way, they're just mistaken. In the 8th chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus refers to the Word of God as being seed. Seed that's sown in a field, and when that pure seed grows up, it produces a certain kind of product. The New Testament church filled with Christians. Each seed brings forth after its own kind. As long as the same sort of seed is planted, the same kind of a product comes out of it. We can plant that same New Testament seed today, 2,000 years later, and come up with the same product that they had back in the first century. By its very nature, it cannot produce the confusion that we find in the denominational world. But a lot of the seed that's being sown today in the name of Christianity is not pure New Testament teaching. It's a mixture of some New Testament teaching with a lot of human creeds and philosophies and dogmas and ideas. Now, Jesus Christ referred in the 13th chapter of the book of Matthew, he referred to those who sow bad seed as the enemy. I don't think we're amiss in thinking of them in that way, even though some of them may mean well. A lot of people who are religiously inclined and believe that they are right with God are unaware that preachers and priests and rabbis can and often do teach doctrines that are false. But Jesus warned, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inward they are ravening wolves. Matthew chapter 7, verse 15. Such an important principle that every seed must reproduce after its own kind. And if we change the seed, then we change what grows up from the seed. God created the first plants by miracle, and then they reproduced in a natural way. And so it was with the church. It was begun by a miracle on the day of Pentecost in the second chapter of Acts, and has been reproducing after its own kind since that time. I believe that since the Lord created the church in the second chapter of the book of Acts, that it always has been reproducing, and it always has existed. I don't believe that since that time the Father has ever been a father without a child in his family. I don't believe that since he built his church, Jesus Christ has ever been a shepherd without a sheep, or a head without a body, or a king without a kingdom. It always has existed there, but tracing it can be difficult, if not impossible, through certain periods of human history. Now, somebody under the age of 23, please tell me about what year, chronologically speaking, the New Testament ended. When we come to the end of the New Testament, about what year are we at with regard to time? All right, that's a possibility. There is some debate as to when the book of Revelation was written. I happen to tend toward believing that the book of Revelation was written a little later than that was, but we're in the right area there. If the book of Revelation was written around 96 AD, which I think it was, based on a statement that Irenaeus made and a few other things, then we're right in the range of about 100 AD for the end of the history of the church as we have it in the New Testament. It's formed in Acts 2, and then the rest of the book of Acts gives us the inspired history of the church. And we have a little bit more about that history in the letters. And then we come to the end of the inspired information that we have about the history of the church. When the New Testament scriptures end in 100 AD, then we have the church going on from that time. But from that time, we don't have anything by inspiration. And in a lot of cases, we have very little at all. Therefore, it's true to say that after 100 AD, nobody knows the history of the Lord's church. And that's a very important point, I think. Nobody knows the history of the Lord's church following 100 AD. Most of it was never written down, and much that was written down did not survive. And a lot that was written down was tainted from the standpoint of authors attempting to please whoever the authority was at the time. Therefore, when we read history, we're seeing a caricature of what actually happened, if it's even that good. Because it's the victors who write the history. Whoever wins the war is the man who commissions the people to write the history, and they're going to write it the way he wants it written or have their heads chopped off. Those are the options that they have. So much of what we read in human history is just a possibility for what happened. Much that was written was not preserved, and much that was preserved was obscured by the fact that the woman clothed with the sun fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God that they should feed her there for a period of 1260 days. Only God knows the true history of His church during that time. We have little hints and little inklings. We have little indications, little glimpses of it through the centuries. But when you read the history of the church by Neander or Mosheim or Schaff or Kurtz or Fisher or any of the other popular histories of the Christian church through the centuries, what you're reading is a history of the apostasy. You're reading a history of the church as it was visible through the years and as people thought of it, not as God was thinking about His church. Now, this apostasy, of course, had been predicted even in the New Testament times. Back in the 2 Thessalonian letter, chapter 2, and I'll just mention there a couple of verses. The third and fourth verses will do us. The Apostle Paul made the statement there, and he was writing in the context of people who believed that the Lord was just about to return and the end of time was imminent. And in order to disabuse their minds of that, he told them that something had to happen before that could come about. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. Now, the expression falling away in this passage is from a Greek term, apostasia. And I mention that to you because this is the place that we get our word apostasy. It means a falling away. The end of the world is not going to come, says Paul, except there be a falling away first. And that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worship, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. It was mentioned yesterday, I think, that in the 20th chapter of the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul there made the statement to the Ephesian elders that even of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them. And this began to occur on a regular basis, even during the New Testament times, but especially after the apostles had been removed from the scene by death, then it became more and more predominant. There were Judaizing teachers who went around teaching, even in Paul's day, that except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you've got no possibility of being saved. Acts chapter 15 and verse 1. And Paul and some of the other apostles fought against that sort of an apostasy. We learned last week that Gnosticism lurked like a large serpent beside the cradle of primitive Christianity. And we also saw that there were other departures from the faith. This was mentioned yesterday. Kyle's talk yesterday morning makes a good introduction to what we're talking about now. He quoted, and I'll just mention to you again, a statement that Paul made somewhat late in his ministry. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, and I haven't been putting these all up here like I intended to, but we had Acts chapter 20 and about the 30th verse there. And in 1 Timothy, I may have said 2 Timothy, but I'm thinking of 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1 and following there. Now the Spirit speaketh expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. It was predicted that this was going to come about. In the fourth verse of the book of Jude, and Kyle, I believe, mentioned this one yesterday as well, so I'll not spend much time on it. We have in the Bible a writing by the man named Luke called the Acts of the Apostles. Somebody called the book of Jude the Acts of Apostates, because it's filled, a little one-chapter book, but it's filled with information about people who did fall away and lead others after them. And in the fourth verse of the book of Jude, he speaks of men who had crept in unawares and were doing just exactly that, as Kyle pointed out yesterday. So, the great apostasy was a result of gradual departures away from the Spirit and the truth of the faith as the Lord had planted it. There are two things that we need as we approach a study like this. We need something, the teacher needs something, and those of us who are talking need something, and those who are listening need something as well, and both of these pertain to the truth. The truth of God here is the polar star, and those who profess to speak the truth of God are supposed to do it in a certain kind of attitude. In the fourth chapter of the Ephesian letter, verse 15, the Apostle Paul there says a mouthful when he says, speaking the truth in love. Speaking the truth in love. Not all of you who are here today were raised in the church, if you'll pardon the expression, and it's not particularly a good one, but it communicates, and in order to replace it, I'd have to use a couple paragraphs to tell what I mean. I think you know what we mean by that idiom, raised in the church. A lot of you were not. Many of you have come to us being converted, but you had other backgrounds. There are some of you who are with us today who are still in some of those other backgrounds. And we want you to understand as we enter into this kind of a study that certainly no one is any more welcome than you are to come and study the Word of the Lord together with us and the history of His church. We're just thrilled to have you here. Some of the things that we will say you may not agree with. And we want you to feel perfectly free to express yourself, to challenge anything that's said. Last week, the verse was mentioned in the latter part of the 1 Thessalonian letter, chapter 5. Prove all things. Hold fast that which is good. The statements that we make need to be challenged to see whether they can stand or not. And the thing about this is that a lot of times when we're in these other backgrounds from the denominational world, or even when we're out of them, but we maybe haven't been out of them very long. It's like a brother said to me, now he's been a Christian for several years, but he was raised in the Roman Catholic background. And he said to me, I think he said it right back there, and it wasn't too long ago that he said this. I had mentioned something in passing about the Church of Rome. And he said to me, you know, I know that what you're saying is true, and I know it needs to be said. But it still stings when I hear it. We all know that that's true, and the reason it's true is that we can give things up intellectually a long time before we can give them up emotionally. And sometimes it takes our heart a long while to catch up with our head. So we're dealing here with some very emotional issues. They're emotional because they have to do with going against the grain of what people's mothers taught them when they were little babies at the mother's knee. And we need to be as careful and kind as we can. Paul said, speaking the truth in love so that we do not unnecessarily offend and hurt the sensitivities of those who are with us from other backgrounds or who have been in other backgrounds. Sometimes those of us who've come from other backgrounds become eventually the most militant ones against that very background because they can see the putridity of it and they want to help everybody else out of it. But we need to be very careful that we speak the truth in love. Now, on the other side of it, I said there are two things about the truth here. Those of us who talk, not only me, but the rest of you, and many of you will be speaking up in this class if last week holds true to form, and I hope that you do. We have to be careful to speak the truth in love. And on the other side of it, those of us who are hearing the things that we say need to be careful not to have a chip on our shoulder about these things. We need to be careful that we receive the love of the truth. Remember that Paul...